Hey everyone, welcome to the Ogilvy Day Stage. Glad you're here. We are very excited to welcome our next speaker, Todd Henry, who's the author of The Accidental Creative, How to Be Brilliant at a Moment's Notice. He's going to talk about creativity. Is it a mystical and elusive force? Can creative people be held responsible for ideas, especially when there are so many factors outside of their control? Todd's been featured in Forbes, Fast Company, Harvard Business Review, and I love his seven-word bio. It's arms dealer for the creative revolution. Please welcome Todd.
Well, thanks so much. It's good to be here. Welcome, all of you beautifully creative people. It's good to be here with you at South by Southwest. And to be relatively dry, which is amazing, and I think it's actually starting to dry. Is it still raining out? I haven't been outside for a while. You haven't been outside either. Okay, never mind. We never had this conversation. It's fine. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book that I just put out called The Accidental Creative. And over the last several years, I've been exploring both as a practitioner, a student and a practitioner, so a student practitioner of the creative process, what would it look like to be prolific, to be brilliant, and to be healthy as a creative professional. Prolific meaning you're doing a lot of work, right? Because we have to do that as people who are accountable for creating every day. Brilliant meaning we're doing good work, which is always helpful. And healthy meaning we're doing it in a sustainable way. And what I found, both as a practitioner and also as a student of lots of other people, is that it's really easy to get two of these three right, right? It's easy to be prolific, meaning you're making a lot of stuff, and to be brilliant, meaning you're actually making good stuff, but to miss on the sustainability piece, to miss on the healthy piece. And that's not going to work over the long term. There's a word for this, and the word is fried, right? And this is the state that many creative professionals live in over the course of their career. These are the walking zombies that haunt the hallways of our organizations, right? Oh, take me to my cube, right? Because we're fried. We're doing great work, and we're doing a lot of it, but we're not doing it sustainably, and that's not going to work for us over the long term. Of course, it's easy to be healthy, meaning, hey, pace of life is great around here, right? And to be brilliant, meaning we're actually doing really good work, but we're not producing at a rate that is consistent with client or marketplace demand, and there's a word for that, and it's unreliable, because we have to produce consistently in order to meet the demands of the marketplace or the demands of our organization. And we all know those people. None of them are in this room, of course, but we all know those people we don't really want on our project team, right? Because they can't quite keep up with everybody else. And that's not going to work over the long run either. And of course, we could be prolific, meaning, hey, we're making a lot of stuff. We could be healthy, meaning, hey, pace of life is great, but our work is terrible, right? And there's a word for that, and it's fired. Because we're not going to keep our job very long if we're not able to produce consistently great work. So my first question for you, and this is really the question that I had as I went about writing this book, is it possible to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy? Are you prolific, brilliant, and healthy, or are you missing one or more of these pieces? And my guess is that probably a lot of us in this room today are, if we're missing out on anything, we're probably missing the sustainability piece. As I look at the marketplace as a whole, I find that a lot of people are missing on that sustainability piece, and that would be corroborated by this number, 80, which represents a stat that came out of a conversation I had with a guy named Tony Schwartz, who wrote a fantastic book called The Way We're Working Isn't Working. I think it's re-releases Be Excellent at Anything. He told me that 80% of people self-report regularly feeling disenfranchised, frustrated, and underutilized in their day-to-day role. 80% of people, right? And add to that that one of the fastest growing contingencies in the marketplace is something they're calling malicious cooperatives. Malicious cooperatives. These are people who are doing what they have to do, not to get fired, but they're secretly hoping the company will tank, right? Which is an astounding thing when you think about it. Why is this the case? Why is it that creatives are burning out at faster rates than ever? Why is it that we can't figure out the sustainability piece and do great work and do a lot of it consistently over time? I think there are a couple of reasons, and the first reason has to do with this guy. Does anybody know who this is, by the way? I would be incredibly impressed if anyone knows who this is. All right, I'll give you multiple choice. Is it A, Dr. Julius Sumner Miller, B, Dr. J, or C, my crazy Uncle Harry pointing at me and telling me to get a real job and stop talking about this creativity stuff? And of course, the answer is not C, thank you. A, Dr. Julius Sumner Miller, Physics is My Business. Dr. Miller does this show on PBS called Demonstrations in Physics. And one day I was home from work, legitimately sick, and was watching Dr. Miller, and he was doing an experiment. He had a yardstick in one hand and a newspaper in the other hand and this crazy mad physicist look in his eye. And he took the yardstick and laid it on the table, so about half the yardstick was protruding off the edge of the table. And he took a newspaper and put it over the part of the yardstick that was still on the table. And he asked in his best mad physicist voice, "What's going to happen when I hit the end of the yardstick that's protruding off the edge of the table?" Of course, I have some understanding of physics, right? So I know there's a lever there, you've got a fulcrum, right? The yardstick's going to go flying, it's going to break some flasks. This is going to be awesome, right? This is my internal dialogue at this point. But what actually happened when Dr. Miller hit the end of the yardstick? It snapped in half. The yardstick snapped in half. Now, I know that newspaper is not heavy enough to weigh down the yardstick and make it snap in half, right? He went on to explain that the reason the yardstick snapped in half is because there's something like 14.9 pounds of atmospheric pressure pushing down on every square inch of that newspaper. So over the course of the newspaper, there are thousands of pounds of atmospheric pressure pushing it down. And so we don't see the atmospheric pressure, right? We don't feel it necessarily because we've grown used to it. But once we understand its dynamics, we can begin to leverage it to accomplish purposes like snapping yardsticks in half, or maybe flying airplanes, you know, which is a little more productive. Well, I think for many of us, that's kind of what the creative process is like. I think no matter how gifted we are, I think the creative process is this mystical, elusive force that sits somewhere between prayer and the U.S. tax code on the ambiguity scale, right? And I think no matter how many times we've done something successfully, the question is always there for us, can I do this again? Can I do this next time? And can I do it successfully next time? So I think that's a pressure, this mystical, elusive force that is the creative process. The second thing is that we now exist in a create-on-demand world. Meaning, not only are we accountable for having to do this creative thing every day, but we also have to deliver by tomorrow at noon, on time, on budget, in order to keep our job, right? Hello, pressure. And anytime we enter into a create-on-demand world, we're entering a very dangerous world, right? Because we're accountable for something that we maybe don't necessarily have a complete understanding of. And so what I set out to do in the book is figure out how do people who do this really well over the long term, how do they do this successfully? And I came up with a couple of answers. The typical creative process looks like this. You define a problem, right? Kind of first step. The second step is you explore options, multiple. Third step is you choose the best option, hopefully. The fourth step is you execute, as in do it, not as in kill someone. And the fifth step is rinse and repeat, meaning that you have to do this stuff over and over again to get really good at it, right? Now, this seems really obvious, right? This is kind of something we do subconsciously, but the reason I put this up is to show you the way most of us actually engage in the creative process when we're in a create-on-demand environment. And it goes something like this. There are three steps. We panic about the problem. We explore the first option that comes along. We choose that option, and we execute, right? Because we want to ship. We don't want to be people. Are you shipping? I'm shipping. Are you shipping? Right. We're all shipping, right? We execute, but we don't give the process its due diligence. We don't care for our creative process, and we don't build structure into our life that facilitates the creative process. We expect it to appear in the cracks and crevices of our life. And when we do that, we shortcut the creative process. So the way that I found that people who do this and teams who do this successfully over time are able to countermand some of those dynamics of the create-on-demand world is by instilling rhythm in their life, instilling an infrastructure in their life that supports their creative process, even and especially when things get crazy. They build practices that support their creating. And there are five elements that comprise this creative rhythm that we can build in our life. The first is focus. Focus is all about how we define the problem. But we actually live in two economies today, and one of them is growing more and more critical to us, I think. We live in an economy of money, and we live in an economy of attention. There are more and more people who are requiring or demanding our attention today, and we have to decide where we're going to put our attention. There are all kinds of things competing for our focus. And there are some enemies we have to countermand in order to be able to focus properly. A couple of years ago, my family was going to Lake Erie for vacation. Woohoo, Lake Erie. And we were going there for the 4th of July. We were going to go see the fireworks. And as we started to put the kids in the wagon to walk down to the lake, our middle child, Owen, starts protesting. I mean, screaming bloody murder. I'm not going to go. And like a good dad, of course, I said, shut up and get in the wagon, right? So we put him in the wagon and we start walking down to the lake. And as we get closer and closer to the lake, Owen starts screaming. I mean, screaming bloody murder like he'd just seen a vampire. Jumps out of the wagon and starts running the other direction, right? Back. And so I chase him down. Owen, it's okay, son, it's all right. The fireworks aren't going to fall on you. The fireworks are perfectly safe. It's okay. It's all right. And Owen said, Dad, I'm not worried the fireworks are going to fall on me. Fireworks make my feet fuzzy. At first I turned to my wife and said, what are you feeding my child, right? And the second thing I said was, what are you talking about? Fireworks make your feet fuzzy. He said, yeah, like at Disney World. And I'm like, okay, what is going on, right? Rod Serling's going to walk out. Some kind of crazy thing is going to happen. And I suddenly had a flashback to the prior year. And I remember that the prior year we went on a family trip to Disney World. And because our youngest daughter, Ava, had really, you know, she was really small, so she rode around in the stroller the whole time. Our oldest child was able to walk with us. But Owen, he has tiny little legs, right? He spent the day riding around on my shoulders. So we're walking around the park at Disney World for a couple hours. Owen's riding on my shoulders. We walk in front of Cinderella's castle. And at the climax of this show, there's a giant plume of fireworks that goes off. Poof, right? In his fireworks-induced startle, Owen suddenly realized that while riding around on my shoulders for 2 hours, his legs had fallen asleep, right? So for a year, my son had walked around with the assumption that fireworks make his legs immobile, right? That's why he didn't want to go. He thought he was going to be paralyzed, right? Crazy. So we had to talk about causality, correlation. You know, I don't think he quite got it. But when you think about it, we do the same thing all the time. We do the same thing all the time. We fossilize around assumptions in our life and in our world. And those fossilized assumptions prevent us from focusing or looking at potentially useful places. So one really valuable practice we can build into our life is to regularly ask, okay, are there any assumptions here I've fossilized around? Do I need to ask these questions again? Right? Is there something that we learned 20 years ago or 10 years ago or 5 years ago that we need to revisit or that I need to revisit? So that's the first thing that battles focus. The second thing is what I call the ping. And the ping is this perpetual pinprick in your gut that says something like, you should go check your email right now, right? Or you should go check your Twitter feed. Or you should go check your cell phone because maybe the president of the United States is calling you with a national security crisis, right? But you see, the ping is this thing that tells me something out there is more important than whatever is in front of me. And it makes me think that I need to be constantly fracturing my attention in order to feel productive, but what it's really doing is robbing me of my productivity. Merlin Mann calculated, I saw him write once, that if you check your email every 5 minutes over the course of a year, over the course of an entire year, you will check your email. Now, I don't mean going into your email, okay, 5 minutes, most are like 5 minutes, every 5 seconds maybe, right? 5 minutes, let's say 5 minutes, not going into it, not doing anything about it, just checking it. Over the course of a year, you will check your email 24,000 times. 24,000 times, right? What do we do other than breathe? Many of us check our email. And that's not going into it, that's not doing anything about it. Now, I took this stat a little farther and calculated that if every time you glance down to see if that little icon has a red number on it or is bouncing, every time you do that, let's say it takes you 10 seconds to refocus your attention. Just 10 seconds. Most experts would say 2 to 3 minutes to really regain your depth of focus. Over the course of a year, you will spend 66.6 hours not doing anything about your email, not going into your email, just checking to see if anything out there is more important than whatever is in front of you. How many of you struggle with time in your life? Yeah, we all do, right? We all struggle with time for our priorities, and yet we think nothing of letting the ping rob us 10 seconds at a time. We've done a couple of things here. 666, we have effectively proven email is evil, right? So you're welcome. But we've also proven that we have the ability to reclaim our time and reclaim our focus, reclaim our attention. We need to get better at defining problems and focusing in on problems. I am speeding through this, right? I'm distilling 5 years of stuff into like 20 minutes, so we might actually time travel. I'm really sorry about this. You might want to hold on to your seat. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the second element. So focus. Focus is important. The second element is relationships. There is a myth out there of the lone innovator that somebody in South Georgia right now is in a cabin inventing the next iPad, right? It's not going to happen. It might happen. Probably not statistically going to happen. Innovation tends to be the collective grasp for the next. But many of us only have relationships of obligation, like Aunt Mildred wants to have tea, or convenience. These are people I hang out with because we work together or because we're in some kind of group together. But we're not building purposeful relationships into our life that stimulate us, that challenge us, that cause us to see the world in a new way. When was the last time you built relationships into your life that cause you to see the world in a new way, cause you to think about things through a different lens. And there are some specific practices we can do. Building a circle, right? Getting together 4 to 6 people and asking 3 questions. Number 1, what are you working on? Number 2, what can we help you with? Number 3, what's inspiring you? Right? And asking these questions of people and just seeing what they say and feeding off of one another's creative process. Again, innovation is the collective grasp for the next. It is not a solo sport, right? So that's relationships. The third element is energy. And energy is all about how we manage not our time, which we're really typically pretty good at, and most productivity systems are aimed at helping us manage our time, but how do we manage the ineffable part of our creative process, our energy? We stack meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, but by the end of the day, we have nothing left to give because we've not been effectively managing our energy. And the creative process, like any process, requires energy. You know, in a vineyard, one of the primary roles of the vine keeper is to regularly prune new areas of growth off the vine. Perfectly good fruit, by the way, off the vine. Why would they do that? Why would a vine keeper prune perfectly good fruit off of a vine? Because they know that if they don't do that, eventually, over time, that fruit will steal resources from the older, more mature fruit-bearing parts of the vine, and the entire vine will succumb to systemic mediocrity over time if they're not careful at managing that new fruit. Well, as creative people, as people who work with our mind, we don't have a shortage of new projects that we would like to take on. We don't have a shortage of new initiatives. Right? But we have a shortage of energy. There's only so much that we have to give. So we need to be relentlessly pruning in our life and making sure that we're focusing on the most important stuff. And again, it's a broad overview of energy. Stimuli is the fourth element. Stimuli. And this pertains to all of the stuff that goes into our head. You know, there's an old saying about food that you are what you eat. So you become what you put into your body. Well, the same thing applies to your creative process and to your mind. You create what you take in. But many of us go through our day indiscriminately snacking on stuff, right? Snacking on stimuli, snacking on RSS feeds, snacking on whatever is coming across our desk. But we're not building things into our life that cause us to think in new ways, that allow us to commune with great minds, right? That causes us to look at things through a different lens, that challenges our fossilized assumptions. We need to be building a study plan. Sorry, but we need to be building a study plan into our life, pursuing our curiosities intentionally. Go in the place where your mind naturally wants to go, but it's a little hard, right? We have to build structure around that. The greatest leaders and the greatest creatives throughout time have been people who commune with great minds, who study great minds, who filled their head with great thoughts. Are you filling your head with great thoughts, or are you snacking? Right? And are you taking notes? Are you paying attention to your intuitions? I love how in his biography of John Adams, David McCullough writes that John Adams frequently had more words in the margin of his books than were on the actual page because he was arguing with the author, right? He was voraciously arguing, saying, this is not true. How could this author think this? He saw a book as a dialogue, not a monologue. Are you passively consuming things or are you interacting, processing, taking notes, paying attention to your intuition? Because guess what? Your mind is always working trying to solve problems. If you want to be brilliant at a moment's notice, you need to begin far upstream from the moment you need a brilliant idea. Okay? So are you putting good things into your head? And finally, the final element is hours. Hours, and this relates to your time, how you spend your time. Time is the currency of productivity. At the end of the day, where you spend it will determine your success or failure. But many of us only think about efficiency when it comes to our time and not about effectiveness. So we'd rather spend an hour cranking out email or returning phone calls, but we don't do the things that are very important to our creative process. I'm one of the biggest Noah Scalin fans in the world. Noah, who just spoke here a few minutes ago. And he and I have talked many times. I've done interviews with him because I think his Scala Day project points to something that I found most productive creatives have in their life, which is what I call unnecessary creating. I go into a lot of design firms, ad firms, you know, brand architecture firms, and I'll sit down with a designer or a creative director and I'll say, let me ask you, when was the last time you made something that somebody wasn't looking over your shoulder paying you for? And it's astounding how often the answer is, I don't remember. I can't remember the last time I made something I wasn't being paid for. Right? And over time, in your career, as you get into the groove, as you get on the rails and you're cranking and you're going, right? It gets easier and easier to abandon these things that feed your creative soul. So do you have things built into your life that feed your creative soul that are remarkably effective, but not the most efficient things? Right? Again, the broad overview of hours. By the way, if you want to know where your priorities are, look at your time, look at your calendar and look at your checkbook. That'll tell you what's really important to you, right? So focus, relationships, energy, stimuli, hours. They unfortunately spell the acronym FRESH. That was thoroughly unintentional. Actually, originally, hours was time, and my editor, David Moldauer, said, right now you have FREST, and FREST is not great. Can we change that to something else, right? So we ended up with FRESH, and they're in a different order. But anyway, FRESH, it'll help you remember it. Focus, relationships, energy, stimuli, hours. Now, why, right? Why do we do this? Is our goal just to crank out a little bit more work? Is that what we're trying to do here? You know, is our goal just to eke out the competition, right? Maybe to win the next contract, maybe just to produce one more great product. Is that really our goal here? Or is there something more to this? Is there something more that we're trying to tap into by being purposeful about our life and about our creative process? In other words, the question could be rephrased this way. Why would anybody care if you disappeared into a giant sinkhole in the earth? What unique space are you occupying on this earth? See, when we become frantic, when we become reactive, when we don't care for our creative process, it becomes all about how can I squeeze out a little more work? How can I crank through a little more? But we're not thinking about what unique space am I occupying on this earth, right? What do I uniquely have to contribute? I love how one of my favorite thinkers, Thomas Merton, talks about this. He says, there can be an intense egoism in following everybody else. People are in a hurry to magnify themselves by imitating what is popular and too lazy to think of anything better. Hurry ruins saints as well as artists. They want quick success, and they're in such a hurry to get it, they cannot take time to be true to themselves. And when the madness is upon them, they argue that their very haste is a species of integrity. Ow. That hurts me, right? You see, we live in a world and we're in an industry where everybody's chasing everybody else's tail. Everybody's trying to be the next. What, who's the next? What's the next, right? And I think that is a profoundly uninteresting question. I'm very interested in the first, right? That's why since the beginning of our company, we've had a phrase that's kind of been at the core of our ethic. Cover bands don't change the world, right? And a cover band's a band that plays other people's music, and that's great, right? They fill clubs, they make a little bit of money, that's fine. But at the end of the day, people go home thinking about the music, not talking about the band. There are a lot of cover bands in the marketplace, a lot of cover bands who want your job right now. By being purposeful about your process, you can begin to occupy a unique space like Noah did, right? Like Noah did. He talked about it. His world is different because he embraced these ethics of treating his process more carefully. I'll leave you with one final thought. A couple of years ago, a friend of mine from South Africa was in a meeting with a bunch of us, and he asked, what is the most valuable land in the world, right? And so we're all thinking, I don't know, diamond mines of South Africa, I don't know, Austin Convention Center, Middle East, oil fields, whatever. And my friend from South Africa said, no, it's none of those things, The most valuable land in the world is the graveyard because it's full of all of those unlaunched businesses, all of those unwritten novels, all of those unreconciled relationships where people thought, you know, tomorrow I'm going to get around to starting that. Tomorrow I'm going to be more purposeful about that. And not to go all Dr. Phil on you guys, right? But I think for many of us, we live with that perpetual, well, tomorrow I'm going to get around to this. Tomorrow I'm going to be more purposeful. Tomorrow I'm going to empty myself of what's in me. And from that day on, I actually wrote two words, put them on my door. I see them every single morning. And these two words were the source of my business. They were the beginning of my ending up writing a book in my labors to free creatives every day. These two words really have been the driving ethic for me in my life. And those two words are die empty. Because at the end of the day, when I lay my head down on my pillow, I want to know that I have fully gotten out of me today, not tomorrow, but today, whatever is in me. And by building purposeful practices in your life, in these areas, focus, relationships, energy, stimuli, hours, you can begin to leverage some of that unique stuff that's in you that right now isn't seeing the light of day because you're expecting it to appear in the cracks and crevices. Okay, so be purposeful, take care of your creative process, and please, for the love of God, by all means, die empty. All right? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Do you have a couple minutes?